It gives me an enormous pleasure to introduce our guests who are here today, sitting around our table. So I will be introducing them in that order. I'll start with Anya Prigozhina Kirby. He's the member of Radical Reform Synagogue and originally from Moscow. But Anya is Russian-British, British-Russian, probably I can say by now, because you've lived in the UK for the last almost 30 years. And Anya is the teacher of music.
Yes, hello.
And next to Anya is another Anya or Hannah Andrushuk, who was born in Mariupol, Ukraine, and now lives with her surrogate family here, Rabbi Mark Goldsmith and Nicola Goldsmith.
Hiya.
And last but not least, Rabbi Igor Zinkov, a Russian-born rabbi who's been in the UK for the last 9 years. And Rabbi Igor is the rabbi of Liberal Jewish Synagogue and a co-chair of the World Union for Progressive Judaism Ukraine Emergency Fund.
Hello, it's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting.
And I'm sitting alongside Rabbi Tanya. My name is Phil Dave. I have been associated with EHRS or EDRS, as it was before, since the age of 8, so I won't tell you how long ago that was, but let's just say I've been part of this shul for a very long time, so it gives me a great pleasure to sit alongside and to try and steer whatever conversation unfolds. Now, the conversation that we're going to have is obviously, as you may have gathered from our guests, to do with the situation in Ukraine at the moment between Russia and Ukraine. And I think it's important to stress that at no point this evening do we want to try and sort of start pointing fingers of blame or anything like that. This is, we know how we all feel about that. I believe what is more beneficial is to actually try and sort of see how we feel that we may be able to find something in the way of a resolution and also possibly sort of where Judaism plays a part in that.
But also to have a bigger conversation about minorities, which obviously Ukraine to a certain extent falls into that category, as well as probably Belarus, being the border countries between sort of, say, Russia and Europe. And through the centuries, looking at the history, we can see both countries constantly being that geopolitical victim of the circumstances and often ending up paying high price in all the geopolitical games which are happening right now in the world as well. So the bigger conversation for us, looking at the theme of our series, is it possible for small countries like Ukraine, who is suffering an enormous loss at the moment, trying to fight for its independence, whether there is a future for the sense of national identity, or is this kind of narrative of minorities or small countries always going to end up being part of a bigger empire?
Ukraine is much smaller than Russia, but there are countries that are much, much smaller than Ukraine. If you think about Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, their resolution so far was to join NATO. What does NATO guarantee us, its members? Only one thing. You probably would not enter war. In my view, NATO is a remarkable achievement. NATO countries, before they became NATO countries, used to fight with each other tooth and nail, and we know exactly what was happening only a few decades ago. And when they came up, it was a gradual process. It was United Nations, and before it was League of Nations. And when they created this unity, the NATO countries do not fight with each other. And anybody else would think many times before invading NATO countries.
They may think twice before invading NATO countries, but at the same time, it's clear to most people that Putin clearly feels very threatened by the prospect of Ukraine joining NATO. And, you know, arguably that's sort of like half of what his stance and his attacks are based on, is sort of saying, you know, this is how Russia can flex its muscles and therefore you won't join NATO or else, kind of thing. Do we really think that just the rest of the world, who is not necessarily a NATO member, is actually that put off by the force of the collection of NATO countries? I'm not so convinced by that personally.
Well, I'm not convinced either that Putin is really threatened by NATO. For last more than 20 years, he happily lived shared border with NATO countries, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. For some reason, the big problem arose when Ukraine wanted not even to join NATO. Before the war, Ukraine never spoke about it. It would be dreaming about it, like most Eastern European countries did and still do. But it never spoke about it. It was realistic to, in order to join NATO, you have to pass enormous amount of criteria. They wanted to go to trade with Europe. That's all they wanted to do. In my view, it's deeper. The situation is much bigger. They wanted to join the modern world, from which Soviet Union and post-Soviet ethics of economical organizational relationship dragged them from. So, and then Putin is coming up with this idea of being threatened by NATO. And I don't believe it. And I would challenge anybody who would tell me what reasons does he have to be scared of NATO. In what way NATO threatened Russia? It used to be the case of the standoff, yes, when Russia was part of Soviet Union, absolutely, when two very conflicting worlds were very much against each other and people lived in constant fear of nuclear war or any war. But I remember very well, I was in my early 20s, when all the changes happening, when the West was so delighted, there was no standoff anymore, and they gave us enormous amount of help, and I remember that. So I don't see how, what exactly NATO did to threaten Putin. To me, it's a myth.
It's interesting because on the one hand, I agree with you, but on another hand, isn't the same fear which European countries have now over the Russian aggression? Because probably if we would agree that Putin was threatened and Ukraine will join, wouldn't it be the sense of, well, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia joined NATO, Ukraine wants now, look what happened in Belarus, particularly the last few years of constant movement of people and what we call it, revolt. Who's going to go next? What happened in Chechnya years ago, Georgia war? So for Russian Empire and the sense of Russian imperialism, suddenly losing all these territories is quite a big loss. And the same fear the European countries have, because one of the most threatening things, or at least that's what I saw in Poland, I've heard when I was talking to Polish people when we were there working with the refugees, it was the threat of Russian invasion. So if Ukraine falls, which country is next?
Very good question. Absolutely.
Anya, let's find out from you, when, because obviously sort of having stemmed from Ukraine, I think that you would be best place to sort of tell us a bit about sort of how you felt that the feeling was, if you like, in Ukraine in the run-up to Russia invading. Now, obviously, we know about Crimea for many years, but sort of more when Putin made an effort to start taking Kyiv and Mariupol and what have you. What was the feeling like sort of in the run-up? Was there anticipation, or was it a shock that Putin did what he did?
I would start from replying to what was saying before, because I think it's important to talk about Ukraine also from perspective of Ukrainians. First of all, Ukraine is not a small country. I would like you to imagine it like a quite big country. And yes, comparing to Russia, we are very small, but it's a lot of people, lots of territories. And what's happened when we are talking about Russia's imperialism, I absolutely support it as an aid. I mean, not support it. I understand. I suggest what you mean by that. And what's happened in Ukraine, if we come back to 2014, 2013, Ukraine has its independence since 1991. And since then, we started to develop a strong society year by year, but especially in the last couple of 9-10 years, I would say we come to the point when we don't want to be influenced and we don't want to be a kind of support this idea of one nation. Because we are not, we are independent country. And that's what people strongly feel in Ukraine. It's what I want to emphasize, that we developed our country a lot. We developed lots of things. We developed basically society that allows us to stand out of Putin influence. If you remember, not only Crimea happened, but revolution happened in Ukraine. And we, you know, Putin affected Ukraine via politicians who he supported to kind of send us the Russian messages, Russian way of developing country, and we stand over it. We said, no, we not support this way of developing our country. We want to go towards Europe, and we want to develop. We don't want to stay in this Soviet Union party. Like, we don't like it. That's not our story anymore. We stopped it. And that's what people still feeling very strong. And people were angry about invasion. People were angry about it in 2014, and even more people were angry and still angry now, because it's nothing like okay. Because if you know international law, you should not invade other countries. Just basically, that's enough. And people are very, very angry about it. I don't know any people who would support it. And that's very interesting conversation we are about to begin.
You know, what I find most bizarre out of all of it, though, is that I don't understand how we knew that Crimea was invaded back in the early 2010s, and yet no one really bats an eyelid. You know, we spoke about it. There was talk in the news, oh, isn't it terrible Russia doing Crimea? And yet it sort of took a sort of more full-on attack to Kyiv, to Mariupol, and to other parts of Ukraine before people actually really started making a song and dance out. I can't help but wonder whether or not if maybe other countries would have acted a bit sooner and kicked up the fuss that we're making now, quite rightly, the fuss that we're making now, a bit sooner, maybe we wouldn't actually even be having this conversation now, Rabbi.
Well, first of all, I think it's important for me to say that I am... not a geopolitical expert, and they don't teach it yet at the rabbinic school. Probably they should. I think that the lack of reaction to the Crimean invasion is probably one of the reasons why the Russian invasion to Ukraine happened. I don't think it's the only one. Growing up in Russia, and also. Looking at it now from the outside, I would call what's the feeling of what's Russian psyche or Russian understanding of the world is that I would call it phantom pain. The phantom pain is something that if somebody loses a limb but still can feel the pain of it. The break of the Soviet Union and the time after it had a tremendous impact on the understanding of Russian self-identity. Russia sees itself as a successor of the Soviet Union and the Russian Empire. You may argue that Kyiv is more of a successor of Russian Empire than Russia, simply of for the historical reasons and where the center was. But this is not how Russian people see it. This is not how Putin sees it. I think there is this post-imperial phantom pain going on, and this idea of the world as divided by clear areas of control. So this is, if I don't control something, it means that others do, and others are not us. It's quite a black and white picture. And if you would live in this kind of world and see NATO approaching your borders, you would see the threat. I'm not suggesting for a bit that Ukraine should have done anything. It's not my role, and I think that Ukraine should have a right to define their own future, and that's very simple. But I can see that for Russia and for Putin, I think he genuinely believes that that NATO is a threat, and therefore he will do everything to protect. And this is why, by the way, I don't think that this war has a potential to end very soon at the moment.
I was very struck by what Anya from Mariupol said about Crimea, because I know that was 10 years ago. This has been going on for 10 years. It's not been going on just for 15 months or 18 months. And I remember back in 2014, a synagogue that I was serving then, I'm Rabbi Mark from this synagogue, Edgware in Hendon, of the synagogue I was serving then, we had a strong link with a Jewish community in Kerch in the north of Crimea. I had the chance to go visit there and to see this interesting mix of cultures. There were Ukrainian speakers, there were Russian speakers, there were Tatars as well. It really was a mix. And when that invasion happened, it was really confusing, really, really confusing, because of, was this something that the community could deal with, could live with? Was it not? But what we did know was a sovereign state had been invaded and the action was virtually zero. So 10 years on, as far as I know, the Kerch community has pivoted towards Russia. The Simferopol community that was once there has gone, mostly. And, you know, it's had catastrophic results. But that was an invasion 10 years ago with very little action. And that's really weird to me to say, what do we do when that's the case?
We're talking about Kyiv, we're talking about Crimea, but we've forgotten that in 2014, Donetsk and Luhansk region was invaded and taken off by Russia. I am from Donetsk region, and for me, war started in 2014. And in 2015, I was waking up by the bombings in my city, because 2022 is not a surprise for me. And we're forgetting that lots of territories were taken off. If you imagine that Wales was taken out of UK, that's what happened to Ukraine by that, back to 2014. And yeah, some experts will say that if Putin back then continued and has enough power, he would have taken all the country because of the weak level of the army. But because we hasn't stopped it back then, that's happening now. I'm 100% sure.
It's so interesting, you know, listening to both Rabbi Mark and you, Anya, it reminded me of a conversation which I had in Poland last year with a member of progressive Jewish community called Kazimir. He said that his fear and his friends' fear that what's going to happen to Ukraine is exactly what happened years before to Chechnya, to Georgia, when Chechnya's civil unrest ended up in ruins, certainly second time round. And now those people in that Chechnya, the country which tried to fight for independence, was fighting on the Russian Empire side and killing Ukrainians. And his fear that the same will happen with Ukraine, because there is no way to stop Russia. And that's the comparison, a country with almost unlimited human resources, and to be honest, not caring much about those resources either, and that the aggression will not be just stopped there. So the question is, what does it mean for Ukrainians, which, as we know, losing 100,000 of young people, the whole generation right now?
Thank you for bringing that on the table, because I went back a couple of weeks ago, and what I seen from the streets of my lovely country, it was just women and old people and men without some limbs, or very few men. And I have lost quite a lot of my friends back then in Mariupol, and I keep receiving this very bad, surprisingly bad news still back from then. And lots of my friends fighting on the front line, and every day I'm just suddenly discovering or start my day with news that some of them died. And the problem here is that Russia is losing just whoever they're taking people from prisons, and you know what I mean by that. And we taking the best. Our men who are fighting on the front line are the best. I can't say more. And the damage that this war is making to our genophonte, if I can say that, or to our the whole picture of society is awful, because lots of activists who were the core of our civil society, lots of economists, lots of experts, lots of artists, art person or whatever, they won't belong to this to army. Nobody was born to fight to be the soldier. I don't know anybody who was born to be that person and just to die there. And we're losing the best.
You know, what a powerful statement, seriously. No one was born to be a soldier. No one was born to fight. Anya, you're sort of fiercely nodding along as well with this as well. So I mean,
yes, there is absolutely, I completely agree. It's a very good point. Russian majority of soldiers that are dying in Russia, how much we can sympathize with them on purely human level. We don't want any person to die. I quite agree that the cream, what we call of cream of Russia, either left Russia a long time ago. They still, surprisingly, Putin didn't close the borders. He didn't go as far as Stalin did. My cousin, my nephew, my classmates, picking up anything they could pick up, run to Kazakhstan, to Turkey, to Cyprus. There were still quite a few countries you could run away. It's miserable existence. It's not easy, and nobody is particularly welcoming to members of such state. However, they did it in order not to kill, and frankly, not to be killed. So next option, not to fight, is still available. You can go to prison. What does it guarantee you? Pretty miserable existence, but you eat three times a day. Yes, you are bullied, but your life probably would be spared, and you are guaranteed dignity that you are not participate in the most probably evil thing that happens in this century, and hopefully the last. So for us Russians who live here, who still bear Russian passports, I do it for one sole reason, that my mother is still there, who could not leave Russia for other reasons. So for us, we do ask questions. Why? You don't have to do it. You don't have to obey. You can disobey, and you don't have to go to war. There are a few answers, and I have a few answers. Igor started with Russian mentality, unfortunately. What kind of mentality? Some, I believe it's only minority, genuinely believe that they're protecting their country, and not very bright minority if you open your eyes. If you have internet, it's very difficult to think that anybody of average IQ would believe such thing. They're always fringes, loud fringes. Majority who do fight, people who don't have their opinion, who find it easy to comply, who probably from that kind of people, of probably majority of still Russian people, who have this very false sense of, very undeveloped sense of self-identification. They think that they absolutely must support whatever the government does. And the government equals Russia in their mind. We were told in Soviet Union, for example, we had to swear an oath of pioneer organizations that we would die for motherland. We would do anything our party, our motherland tells us to do. That was Soviet Union. But mentality is still there. I meet lots of Russian people who live here for decades and still feel can't speak badly of Putin, of Russian army, because they have this very bizarre, to my view, distorted sense of self-identification.
But while we're speaking, so Ukrainians are dying and Russian people are dying as well. So the picture is quite grim.
Grim, yes. But I suppose the thing that crops into my head through all of this is it would be remiss with three rabbis sitting around this table for me to not ask, what can we, if you like, take away from our religion from all of this? You know, how are we supposed to interpret conflict? How are we supposed to deal with conflict? What is it that our religion actually tells us that our response should be to this kind of situation?
No pressure on Russian-born Rabbi Igor Zinkov.
I was going to say, not that I'm staring at you, Rabbi Igor, but... Yeah. You know.
One of my teachers used to say that as a rabbi, I am commanded to hope. And it's not your choice to have hope, but you are commanded to hope. And the lesson goes back to Moses, who didn't comply with God even, and who didn't even agree with God's harsh judgment on people, and convinced God to spare them from the destruction. And even though Moses himself witnessed the probably really dark side of Jewish people at that time, betrayal of everything that they fought, for. I mean the golden calf episode. So what can we do now? I remember. So this is now the area of theodicy. Why bad things happen to good people, and what can we do to improve the world? I think that you do a good thing, not because with it the world will be perfect, but because without it the world will be even darker. So you choose to do small good thing for a person, for family, do a little donation, do something manageable, simply because you know that this is the right thing to do. We know lots of stories of righteous among the nations, those people who helped Jewish people during Holocaust to survive, even though the cost of it was potential loss of their own life. So why did they do it? Not for the fame in the future, but simply because it was the right thing to do. And I actually think that this is one thing that humanity have learned since the Second World War, is acceptance of refugees today is much, much better than it was during the Second World War. More people open their house. More people are welcoming and supportive of Ukrainian refugees. More people. It's still not enough, and probably it will never be enough. Understanding the horrible and terrible price that Ukrainian people are paying. But still, this is something that I saw when I also went to Poland to work to support some refugees. And I've been speaking to many organizations and people who support refugees. And I think that this is one of the lessons we have to learn, and we have to continue to learn. We can't stop this war at the moment, but what we can do is to make the life of some people a bit better.
Absolutely. Well, so say all of us for that. Goodness. It's a couple of things to pick up on. The one thing that annoys me is that there's, I think, regardless of what side of the political fence one sits on, and I would insist that people bear with me here, I'm not going too much off on a tangent here, but when we see in the news stories about people who come to the UK allegedly seeking refuge, but it becomes very apparent that not everyone is seeking refuge. In my humble opinion, what that does is it tarnishes, it hampers those who genuinely do need help. It almost like everyone's sort of branded with the same brush, if you like, with the same thought process. And as a result of it, it's immeasurably frustrating for me to think that there are people who genuinely do need help, who do need support as refugees, who may be not getting it because there are others who are sort of basically trying to pull the wool and hampering that particular effort.
My name is Pancho Mulongeni, and I'm a candidate for conversion at this shul. So I wanted to ask, actually, I don't actually think it's possible for Home Office, or actually any of these Western countries, to be the arbiter of why someone should flee their country. And I think many of the times they don't want it. They don't want these people, or let's say my people, for example, to go. LGBT people coming to this country, some have even been put in such inhumane conditions. There was even a person from my country, Namibia, who ended up killing himself because he was separated from his friends and family who were here. And he was deemed as, you know, he doesn't qualify. So I think I want to push back and say, who decides and how far must it be? How bad must it be for you to then flee? Do we have to wait for a full-scale invasion? And which invasions count? Which wars count?
So that's a very good point, I would say, because back in 2014, I didn't even know that I can escape from what I experienced back then. And talking about now, that's interesting. I mean, I understand what you're asking about, but that's basically UK doesn't judge people, doesn't judge Ukrainians for those who need more or who need less, because UK opened border for everybody who think they need this support. But how you really can judge if there is a war going on? I mean, as a person from Eastern Ukraine, the part of Ukraine that has been invaded very much before 2022 and experienced all these horrors for a long time, I used to think a bit like you, like, why people from West Ukraine should come or anything like that. But then bombings happening every day in every bit of country, and you can't judge. I mean, my therapist would say there is a different barrier for everybody. For me, the maximum would be, I don't know my maximum, I've seen such a shit, I'm sorry, but for a person from Western Ukraine, sirens and just the whole idea of war would be enough to leave the country and to ask for this support and to ask for host or something like that, because the mentally we can't say we are all the same, and I don't think we should choose who needs more or who needs less. It's just we can't do it.
Yes, this is very true. I suppose that there would be some who may say, and it is only right to put this across, that everything has a cost, and in particular in the UK, there is only so much that the British taxpayer would be prepared to pay for and be actually capable of paying for. And there will be, whether we like it or not, people who would say that. You know, you don't necessarily have to agree with that point, but I feel that that is something that there will be some listening to this who would probably put that as an alternative.
First of all, I don't think there is a competition in suffering. I don't think you can say that, oh, your suffering is only 50 points and your suffering is 55 points and therefore you are a better sufferer than... I don't think it works this way. I think if there is will, there is a way of doing it. During COVID, we saw that if there is a will to support people, to support financially, to support with... providing healthcare, with support, with providing everything that's necessary, there is a way of doing it. Yes, there is a cost, but we can deal with it. And I think this principle is quite important. What is the right thing to do? You can either turn people away, or you can accept people with an understanding that probably 1 out of 10,000, 1 million would be abusing the system, but still, it's worth it. Because what you will end up with, you will end up with a lot of extremely grateful people who want nothing else than to pay back to this country, to this society, and to pay back the kindness of people who accepted them, supported them, trained them, taught them English, and gave them safety, work, house, and everything.
Just wanted to add my bit. This is Nicola. I'm Anya's host, bonus mum. And I just want to say, from a host point of view, having Anya as part of our life has been unbelievably positive experience and really rich. And really genuine. And, you know, I have an extra daughter forever. But actually, it was a really soul searching for me that when the plea went out for the Ukrainians to find host families, and we immediately signed up, it made me question why I've not done it before. And why was there something about the Ukrainian condition that meant it spoke to me very deeply, whereas a very close friend of mine has been hosting refugees for years quietly, you know, to support the system that, you're completely right, is terrible, treats other people very badly, you know, whether you're coming over from Afghanistan or Syria, or you're fleeing persecution for all sorts of other reasons. It just made me think, why have I not done this before? And why is this different? I don't have the answer other than
Excited. I genuinely thought that you found the answer.
There isn't an answer, but actually it really did make me think that it questioned my behavior previously about why hadn't I, it's been such a positive thing for all of us. It's made me really question why I've not opened my doors and my heart to other people in the past.
Do you mind if I say sort of what may be an answer to that straight away? And that is, it's curious that you say about opening your door before, because a situation that is not necessarily to do with someone who was a refugee, but I won't go into detail, but let me just say that there was a situation where I had to lend my sofa to someone who was in need very, very recently. We're talking literally within the last couple of weeks. And I'd never done anything like that before. Always been brought up to believe that you have to be very closely guarded. You have to protect what's yours. You've got to be very aware that others may not necessarily have the best of intentions, and therefore, you know, you can't just sort of go flinging your doors open and hoping for the best. You have to be aware of what you're doing. And so, of course, I've been brought up to believe that. And I actually think that we live in quite a suspicious country. You know, you have to think of sort of the way that we treat others, total strangers on the street. If anyone goes within near a certain area of you within the pavement, you'll move away from them. You won't move near, you won't say hello or anything like that. That's just genuinely how we've been brought up in Britain, to almost be wary of others. But when I did do what I did, a couple of others actually sort of, who I did tell about this before, said to me, "You're ridiculous. How can you do this? What's wrong with you? You know, don't you see you're being taken for a fool? You're being taken as a mug here." And I mean, to be honest, it's a look I get used to after a while, but it's more about that I thought, well, no, I've got to try it, because then I'll know. And needless to say, the person who I did help was very grateful, and I believe that nothing more other than I just helped someone. So I think that if we break down that need to be suspicious of everyone around us, or that mindset that in this country that we have to be wary of others, then actually I feel like maybe more people would be open to the idea of opening their doors and helping people.
How did it make you feel?
It made me feel a bit guilty, because I guess I thought to myself, well, why have I thought like this for so long? Without actually realizing that maybe it's not all bad. And the other part of me, it made me feel very aware of how lucky I am. How lucky I am to have what I have, and to be able to just get up in the morning, go to my own kitchen, grab a glass of water, and get on with my day. Not everyone can do that. And I think it just made me realize that, yeah, I do have it pretty good.
Phil, you asked for some Jewish answers, and I want to kind of go on to Rabbi Hegor's answer, but also to Nicola's. And in a way, part of the question is, why is this refugee crisis different from other refugee crises? And the answer is, it probably isn't. It really isn't. I think Pancho's point is absolutely well taken. There is something about it's Kyiv, it's towns we've heard of, maybe that made a difference. It's place that I happen to have had the privilege of visiting in the past, and just anger at what was happening, just the invasion of a sovereign country like that, and really seeing it. Now, of course, part of that is not properly seeing exactly the same thing happening in other countries, not properly seeing it. But I think there is a Jewish answer to this, which is the most straightforward command to us, which is to love the stranger and to open up our hearts. That's straightforward. And then the question is why we don't sometimes. That is a tough one. But that seems to be so clearly a Jewish imperative and a human imperative.
I think one more reason why more people, I think, took Ukrainian refugees was that the leadership of this country supported it.
I was going to say, can I put it in quite a crass way? I feel it's to do with almost publicity, if you forgive me for putting it like that. It's almost as though that sort of the publicity that the through the news that the war in Ukraine received compared to other issues around the world is probably what made people open their minds and open their hearts a bit more.
Yeah, I'm Vex Hansen, and I just kind of want to jump off that idea of visibility and media coverage and how much of the struggles of people across the world we don't see, but also how that happened with Ukraine. There was a blip of this is happening in Crimea, and then it disappeared. We didn't hear anything about what was happening in eastern Ukraine after Crimea was taken, and it was just forgotten about. And to a certain extent now, after 15 months, we're hearing nothing about the rest of Ukraine. The media has gone really quiet on it. And it was the initial rush to accept Ukrainians that allowed a lot of refugees in. And I worry that when more people realize they feel that they have to leave, that we will have forgotten about them again.
Firstly, say enormous thank you. For Russian, as I say, we always have... our life changed forever since 24th of February. And I was volunteering in job center, translating. And I couldn't believe that these women came with children. All they had was suitcase, that's it. And this country provided this with them with decent living, with financial help, with schools for children. All of them were schooled, those I knew, about 30 of them, maximum within a month. Free, very good quality healthcare. By good quality, I mean I know what to compare it to, right? So, when we speak dreadful, terrible system of helping refugees, when we speak of still things being far from perfect, I believe these institutions, growing social institutions, economical, organizational, should be judged from perspective. Compared to what? Do you know a country that sorted it better? I don't. I looked up. Yes, some countries took more refugees, but I'm in touch with other Russian helpers who are dealing with refugees in Germany. Many fewer people per capita took them in their houses. Government provided them with schools, with decent buildings, and very little else. So we had to collect lots of money to buy them beds and other things. When I looked at those countries that are normally praised as socialistic, Finland, Sweden, many fewer per capita, and the immigration laws are far harder, incomparably harder to get. So what I'm saying is, let's try also to see it in perspective. As Rabbi Igor said, let's look what would have happened only a few decades ago. And I think we've grown so much. And I believe this country was pretty much at the forefront of this growth. Yes, it's far from perfect, but we are humans. I would never believe that humans become perfect and the institutions that humans made are perfect. But the fact that we improved so much, when I saw that these people were hosted, given money, and they go for holiday, I didn't see a single Ukrainian refugee being outside in the street. Again, I didn't see, maybe they exist. To me, it's tremendous achievements. And I'd like you, now my request to you, after my amazing gratitude and trying to put things into perspective, please appreciate what has been achieved actually by previous generations of yours.
One thing I do have to point out, Anya, to you is that, and this may not necessarily come across that well if you are just listening to this. But Anya, there's one thing that stands out a mile to me, is that you are of Russian heritage, say you lived here for 30 years, and yet out of everyone around this table this evening, you're the only one who's donned a blue and yellow ribbon in support of Ukraine. And I think that that's got to be, it's a shame that that's only a visual statement, because I wished it could sort of be translated to audio, what a statement that makes.
Thank you, thank you.
My name is Stuart Winton. Much has been made of Russia invading the Crimea and nothing being done about it. And it has follow on to the current situation where we are regretting it, perhaps. I want to know what the mentality was of the Russian premier, who I believe it was Leonid Brezhnev, in 1991. Why did he give Crimea to the Ukraine, considering there are two military naval bases in the Crimea? We can't understand what the mentality was for giving the Crimea to the Ukraine. It's, I don't know, perhaps you can answer that, please.
My name is Eric Sander. I believe that the reason for that happening is that the Ukraine agreed to give up their nuclear weapons in exchange for what they received from Russia. And that's how it came about.
Khrushchev was from Ukraine himself. And when he was given it to Ukraine, sort of as a gift to his own people, it was also part of the Soviet Union. I just read an article about it because it was really interesting. And apparently at the time, it didn't really matter because it was sort of all the same pile. So it was a nice gesture towards his brethren without any cost to his empire.
Ukraine lost per capita during the Second World War. Ukraine was affected the most and lost per capita many more people than any other republic of Soviet Union, even Russia. Altogether, we lost 20 million, but I can't remember exactly how much Ukraine lost. So to say thank you for the bravery of Ukrainians, that was another mic point. And otherwise, yes, Tanya said that why Khrushchev did it. But exactly, Russian people could go there. I went there. I was working there in summer camps. I loved it. We could go there easily even after separation of Ukraine. It was always kind of ours. So Russian people never lost Crimea until 1914. They always could go there, buy property, enjoy the holiday.
Just to take it in a slightly more conclusive direction, I feel like an awful lot has been discussed. We're all clearly very passionate about what we believe about this situation. But maybe we could just end with looking at what we could be doing as a community, as a Jewish community, to actually help this situation. We're forever taught about tikkun olam, repairing the world. How can we repair this situation?
First of all, thank you for what you already has been doing for all this time, because it's interesting, because from my perspective, UK is doing quite enough. And again, I'm very agree with the point of Anya, comparing to other countries and comparing to what I heard from my friends who were seeking for support from other countries. UK is doing very well, and UK's people, and particularly Jewish UK people, are very welcoming to us. And thank you personally to my family and to all the families who are listening to us and who still may think about taking somebody to their houses. Because I'm very agree with Igor's point. You can do small things that will matter. Every small detail will matter in the huge perspective. If we are talking about a bigger thing, it's just really be kind to each other and don't seek for difference, seek what is common. We're all humans and we all can support each other. And from what I think we can practically do is not forgot that war is still going on every day. I mean, I know that my lovely Goldsmith family monitoring news every day, and I don't even need to tell them what's happened in Rivne, Uzhhorod, Kharkiv, Kherson, or wherever any points they even pronounce perfectly now. So please be aware that the war is going on and people are dying every day. And what you can do from this point is to show your country and to show your government that you do care about it and that you do want to keep supporting us and all other refugees, no matter where they come from and what situation is there, that you do care and you can open your hearts, your homes to us and... yeah, just show it and talk about it and never forget about it.
Since the beginning of the war, I've been involved in the World Union for Progressive Judaism Ukraine Crisis Fund. And what I can see is that in the first half a year, people demonstrated incredible kindness, not only in terms of donating money to charity that supports Ukrainian refugees, but also by opening their houses. And I can see clearly that after about half a year, maybe after a year, it slowed down and almost stopped. To the extent that now, if a Ukrainian refugee arrives to this country, it is extremely hard to find a place for them to live. And most charities that I speak of report that they stopped receiving donations. And I think that this is something that that we can do. Keep opening our houses, keep donating, and keep telling people that it is not over. Well, I think it's still in the news. I think people know it's not over. People just got weary of it. It's very heavy to think about the war all the time. Unlike Ukrainians who don't have choice, many other people have a choice to switch off. And I think that this is what happens to many people. And I think in a way, this is my appeal to turn the switch on again and keep donating and keep opening their house, your houses.
It's like this week's Torah portion reminds us in Parashat Ki Tetzeh, Chapter 22, the opening verses, which says that you've got to look after the property of your neighbor. And why would you? And the Torah says the reason that one should not be indifferent. And isn't that such an interesting commandment? It just to remind ourselves, and that's what the Torah reminds us, one of our ethical and moral imperatives.
As we know, the opposite of love is not hate, but indifference.
I don't know whether or not there's much else to add, really, other than just to say thank you to everyone who has taken part in this discussion. It's been truly eye-opening, I think, for most of us involved. And words might be cheap, but there's one thing that I think that we can all agree on. I very much hope that we find ourselves living in a time where actually this conversation will be had with hindsight and not speaking about the present. But thank you all very much for taking part, and thank you very much indeed at home for listening.